that Defense Secretary James Mattis resigned because he told him to do it. This is USA Radio News.
With a recession ending, if you've been putting off building your business, now is the time to act. General Steel will meet or beat any price on a pre-engineered steel building of the same size and specifications. Act now before steel prices go up. So call us today for free information.
Call 800-965-1290. 800-965-1290. 800-965-1290.
The New England Patriots are champions of the National Football League once again.
Yes, it's still a dynasty.
The call on the Patriot Radio Network as they beat the Los Angeles Rams 13-3. For most of the game, it was a defensive struggle. The score was tied 3-3. Then midway through the fourth quarter, Patriot quarterback Tom Brady took over and led the Patriots on a 67-yard drive. That ended by a 2-yard touchdown run by Sony Michel that proved to be the game-winning score. The Patriots added a field goal at the very end. New England wins their 6th Super Bowl championship. Ram fans were disappointed, but Patriot fans were ecstatic.
Oh, 6, baby! 6, that's all I got to say.
Go Pats! Heck yeah! Brady number 6!
President Trump may face challenges within his own party in 2020. USA's Rick Vincent reports.
Former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld plans to headline Politics and Eggs in New Hampshire in 2 weeks, a must-stop for White House hopefuls, and Maryland Governor Larry Hogan expressed interest this week to CNN.
I'm not protesting every day about every issue, but when I stand up and certainly let people know when I disagree or when I think something is going on that I don't think is right.
And an email this week by former Ohio Governor John Kasich's political group reminded supporters that many have suggested Governor Kasich should run, and he is keeping all of his options on the table. For USA Radio News, I'm Rick Vincent.
For USA Radio News, I'm Wendy King.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com, and I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hutton Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Well, good afternoon. It's a beautiful Friday. I can't believe the how nice it was. They said mostly cloudy. I didn't bring my sunglasses. And, of course, it's been sunny and beautiful, high in the high 50s and about 61 degrees. Tonight, however, there is supposed to be at least a 20% chance of isolated showers and then mostly cloudy. But then by tomorrow, nice day, not as warm as today, but 41 degrees and mostly sunny. By Sunday, it'll be a little bit cooler, 36 degrees, and increasing clouds. And by Sunday night, there's about a 60% chance of snow, likely, and into Monday, for those of you who have off for Washington's birthday or President's Day, as I think we call it now, there's about a 40% chance of rain or snow. Depending on the temperature, it is supposed to get to be about 42 degrees, so that will be rain. And by Monday night, mostly cloudy. And then, of course, when everybody has to go back to work and school on Tuesday, there will be a mostly sunny day, about a high of upper 30s. So, unfortunately, does not look like those of you who have off on Monday are going to have a beautiful day. But that's what it is, and if you have off you from work, you shouldn't complain. I'm Pat Smits, and the program is It's the Law. I don't have a guest. I guess I'm going to have to do better at trying to get some more guests. And so today I'm going to be talking about issues, legal issues. The other thing I want to do is just remind everybody, those of you who are members of the chamber, I hope you will look around and think of who to bring as a guest. We're going to have a future members' breakfast reception. I know it's a little bit in advance. I'm telling you this, it's going to be Monday, March 18th, from 8:30 until 9:45 at Zoop, which is the eatery and the in that shopping center on Rayville Avenue. And your ticket for admission is to bring a prospective member. And in fact, if you are someone who's interested in the chamber, you know, please call me, call the chamber. You're more than welcome. And this should be fun. Learn about the chamber, you know, have breakfast. And actually, I don't know if you've been to Zoop, but it's a, you know, great place for soup and camaraderie. So I'm looking forward to meeting everybody at that breakfast reception. As I said, it's 8:30 to 9:45. Of course, also next week, Thursday night, we have our annual dinner, the Chamber Annual Dinner at the Ryland Inn. If you don't have your tickets, be sure to try to call and get them. I think there's still some possibility that there are a few more tickets available. And Ryland Inn, if you haven't been there, is really a very nice venue. So look forward to seeing everybody there. So what's happening in legal news? And do I have anything else to say? Well, unfortunately, one of the things that's in the news, probably most people have not seen it, are the trials that are going on in Guatemala as a result of the children, all girls, I think it was 41 or 42 of them who died in a fire when they were locked in a government facility, and it was actually a locked facility that was supposed to be protecting the children. They were children who had been taken from their families or parents or others because of abuse. And unfortunately, it was not a good facility. Some of them had tried to escape, and as a result, they locked them in a small room. Locked the boys in a bigger room, locked the girls in a small room, and did not open the doors when the fire broke out. So in any event, one more story of, you know, the tragedies that are going on in Guatemala. For those of you who know me, you know that I have a special fondness for Guatemala, for the people of Guatemala. We lived there. My husband Dave and I lived there. We had our first child born there. And the people were, you know, just wonderful to us. They really were. And it was one of the best times of our lives. And to see the tragedy and the tragedies that are going on now, and don't even get me going with what's going on at the border. So there was a settlement, a $19.2 million settlement, in a lawsuit against the New Jersey gas utility over a gas explosion that destroyed an Elizabeth family, their home, injured six and killed two, and that was finally settled for $19.2 million. And but the tragedy is these people will obviously, never come back. I guess because it's the day after Valentine's Day, we should talk a little bit about some of the things that are going on in Valentine's Day. I was listening to one of my favorite DJs on WDVR this morning at about 6 o'clock, and he was saying that his wife went into ShopRite and was looking in the there were all of these men in the card aisle. Guess what? Of course, Valentine's Day yesterday. But then apparently there was some kind of a snafu at the checkout lines with credit cards, and there were some of these men had no cash to even pay for the cards. So that might have been an interesting excuse. Certainly glad that my husband was able to ease into the fudge shop on 202. Apparently they had somebody directing traffic. They didn't even have enough room to park cars and all of the cars, and the line was out the door. But he did get the dark chocolate, so that's fine. In any event, the day is over, so everybody can kind of breathe a sigh of relief, I guess. But if you didn't think of the fact that it was Valentine's Day, shame on you. So what else is happening? Well, there was the criminal law case that was published, and this was the appellate division, and the appellant, this was a matter of the civil commitment of A.Y. And A.Y., the appellant, appealed from a judgment that was civilly committing him to the special treatment unit, the STU, as a sexually violent predator. And that was pursuant to the Sexually Violent Predator Act in New Jersey, which is found at NJSA 30:4-27.24 to 27.38. This is a very specific statute to deal with sexual predators. And he was convicted of the predicate act of second-degree sexual assault. And that's another statute, a 2C statute. And he was diagnosed as suffering from antisocial personality disorder and other conditions. And so what happened is the state of New Jersey, the experts, their experts opined that his personality disorder affects his cognitive and his emotional capacity, making it highly likely that he will sexually reoffend if not kept under care, control, and treatment of a secure facility, such as the STU. Now, the state's experts in this case relied in part on the results of the MNSOST-R and STATIC, STATIC-99R, actuarial instruments. So these are tests, and they determine, they relied on those, at least in part, to determine whether A.Y. was highly likely to sexually reoffend. And he argued that he had regained the ability to control his sexually assaultive behavior through treatment and medication compliance. And he further argued the state's experts rendered inadmissible net opinions, lacking any probability or basis to find him highly likely to sexually reoffend. Now, this net opinions are, it's an interesting issue because the trial judges always have to determine the basis for an expert's opinion. And the appellant in this case also argued that the state's experts could not point to any methodology or objective standards used to reach their sexual recidivism risk findings. Now, that's important because methodology and objective standards, that's what experts must rely upon, along, of course, with their own expertise. So the appellate division found the state's experts relied on information reasonably relied upon by experts in the field, and also that the state's experts did not render inadmissible net opinions, and also found that the actuarial instruments were properly used by the state's experts in formation of the basis of their opinions. So in other words, that these instruments that they used, these tests, were not the only things that they relied upon. And also that the methodology utilized by the state's experts satisfied the requirements imposed by the court. And that was, these requirements were imposed by the Supreme Court in In Re Accutane litigation. That's a Supreme Court opinion in 2018. And then accordingly, the appellate division determined that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in admitting and considering the testimony of the state's experts, including their use and reliance upon the MN, capital SOST-R, and STATIC-99R actuarial instruments. The appellate court affirmed finding that the credible evidence in the record supported the trial court's finding that the appellant suffered from a personality disorder that makes it highly likely that he will not control his sexually violent behavior and will reoffend if not confined to the STU for treatment. That's the that's a sexually violent predator unit. So this this went up on appeal from the trial court. Trial court was in fact affirmed the decision. So this very very difficult situation, and of course care has to be taken. However, there are certain, unfortunately, there are certain people in society who will, in fact, the prediction is that they will reoffend, and in fact, there are many instances where, when released, they do reoffend. There were a number of unpublished opinions, as usual. There was some bankruptcy real estate cases, interesting, not published, immigration criminal law case, again, not published. So it was, but that one is, I think that is interesting. It was not a New Jersey case, it's a federal case. And there was a pro se petition for a writ of habeas corpus, and by the litigant was a native and citizen of Jamaica who entered the United States on a visitor's visa. He thereafter became a conditional lawful permanent resident. I'm sorry, permanent resident. So he was able to come in on a visitor's visa, then became a conditional lawful permanent resident. However, he was convicted of criminal offenses and sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. Then, while still incarcerated, he was served with a notice to appear and placed into removal proceedings based on his criminal history. This is very, very common. In other words, there usually are detainers when someone is undocumented or can, in fact, be removed based on their criminal activity. Their detainers placed on them, so once they are released from prison, they're not actually released. They are taken into immigration custody. So this is what happened upon release from prison. He was taken into immigration custody while his removal proceedings continued. And then after numerous adjournments, he appeared at the final hearing, at which point his application for, actually more than one, his applications for relief were denied, and he was ordered removed. Then subsequently, the Board of Immigration Appeals dismissed his appeal. He then filed a petition for review of the board's decision with the Third Circuit, and thereafter filed a motion for stay of removal. So the motion for stay in this case has yet to be decided and remained pending before the Third Circuit. Excuse me, did I say circus? I meant circuit. So then he argued that his ongoing immigration detention violated his right to due process because he had been held overlong without a bond hearing. So the court agreed and granted his habeas petition, meaning that, you know, get out of jail, you can't hold me, and ordered the government to provide him with a bond hearing before an immigration judge within 10 days. So the court reasoned that he had been in removal proceedings for more than 2 years and had been held in immigration detention for 18 months. The court found that those 18 months of immigration detention, only about 8 months of delay could be attributed to him. so the rest of the 10 months to the immigration people. So the court held that he continued, that his continued detention absent a bond hearing would be arbitrary and unconstitutional application of Section 1226C. So this meant that at least in this situation, the immigration courts just can't sit back forever. So even though it was a very specific case based on this particular situation, that's why it wasn't published, but it would certainly be a good case for other people who are dealing with the delays in immigration court. There was another, again, administrative law not approved for publication, Johnson versus the New Jersey State Police. And in that case, the petitioner, Kenneth Johnson, and as I said, this can't be used as precedent, but a lot of these cases are still helpful for attorneys and for possible, you know, people who are possibly litigating this kind of a situation. But he appealed from a final decision of the superintendent of the state police. They adopted the initial decision of an administrative law judge, and the administrative law judge denied the petitioner's application for a private detective license. And on appeal, the petitioner argued, this was an appellate division case, and on appeal from the administrative law court, which is what happens, the petitioner argued that the New Jersey State Police was administratively stopped from denying his private detective license because the standards for issuance of the license were identical and that the decision was arbitrary and capricious. Good argument if it wins. So the petitioner had retired from the state police. However, he had retired after admitting he abused sick time and committed other related infractions. As a part of a settlement of disciplinary charges, he was permitted to retire. So then after he retired, he obtained a license to work as a security officer. Then subsequently he applied for a private detective license. That was denied. So in affirming the decision of the superintendent, the court found that the state police engaged in a much more in-depth investigation, and they do that when they're considering an application for a private detective license as opposed to a license for security officer. So further, the court found that the regulatory requirements were different in terms of applicants' character and background. So in other words, it's much more difficult, or at least more difficult, to get a license as a private investigator than as a security guard. So the court reasoned that the investigation for private detective license revealed petitioner's disciplinary history preceding his retirement, and the application was denied based on that history. The court also found that the superintendent's decision was not arbitrary or capricious, and that he was not stopped for denying the private detective license based on an earlier issuance of a security guard license. So, be careful. In other words, there are real problems with getting license, and one of the significant problems often is that people sometimes have license suspended for things like non-child support, non-payment of child support, and or they might have a driver's license suspended for non-payment of child support, and they don't even know it's suspended. But it's very important for anyone who has a license to be very careful, because when you lose it or when you may want to get a license, you have to really be very careful about your criminal background. So let me tell you and bring you some news from some of our sponsors, and then we'll be back for more information. By the way, I noticed that the news at the top of the hour was news from a week ago, so don't know if that's going to be the same problem. I won't play the news during the break, and hopefully that won't create a problem in the for the next hour.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
Well, I'm back and just trying to find some interesting cases that were approved for publication. Frankly, some of them are, in my view, deadly dull. So there's some land use, and unless you're used to or interested in some land use, there was a variance provision. The defendants, that was the borough of Point Pleasant. The trial court decided that declared invalid and unenforceable a variance provision and deed restriction requiring one unit of a subject two-family dwelling to be occupied by the owner and not rented to a third-party tenant. But apparently what happened is the variance and deed restriction were imposed as a condition of the variance, allowing the plaintiff to raise their existing home and construct a new two-family dwelling on their property. So this was a condition imposed upon them. And so then what happened, and that was in a zone, apparently this was allowed, in a zone limited to single-family residences. And in its ruling, the trial court concluded the variance and deed restriction impermissibly discriminated against renters and predicated the allowable use of the property based on the identity of its occupants. So now, on appeal, this is the appellate division, on appeal, the defendants argued the trial court should have dismissed plaintiff's action as untimely. The appellate court rejected defendant's argument and affirmed the trial court's decision, and the appellate court ruled that the trial court correctly applied the principle that zoning acts authorized regulation of land use, not the identity and status of persons occupying the land. Very interesting. So, in other words, the zoning board could have denied the request for a two-family home, but when they granted that request, they couldn't say who can live there. I think that's a distinction that I'm sure that the board probably wasn't even aware of. But that was important because the trial court, I can't imagine that the trial court would have denied the board or the borough of Point Pleasant the right to say you can't build a two-family house in a zoning, an area where it's zoned for single-family dwellings. So in any event, what happened here is the court noted that prior cases had invalidated similar variance conditions. So this was a variance condition. And so that because of that, so this wasn't the first time this has come up. So in response to defendants' concern that seasonal renters would fail to abide by local noise and parking ordinances, the court further concluded that defendant's variance was improperly trying to delegate to the plaintiff, as a private landlord, the borough police powers. Okay, so the borough police can deal with noise, and you can't delegate that to a private citizen. And the police, of course, have the sole responsibility to enforce local laws and maintain the peace. So the court noted that if defendants wish to maintain the single-family character of the neighborhood, it should never have approved the variance, just what I said, in the first place. Finally, the court affirmed the trial court's decision to adjudicate the case under the, quote, interest of justice, end quote, exception, because of the bar, they were out of time. So the court still was able to do that. Because it did so in the interest of justice. So now that they're actually, the trial court also published a decision in the same, and this is interesting, both the appellate court decision and the trial court decision in this case, which was decided on May 3rd of 2018, was published. So they did not publish the trial court decision until after the appellate court decided. So, and that just is a little more information, but it's just basically the same, because the plaintiff filed a complaint, what they call in lieu of prerogative writs, and the complaint sought to an order reversing the borough's decision to deny the plaintiff's application to remove a deed restriction on her residential property. And as I indicated, she was the owner of a two-family residence. Previously, her husband, the plaintiff and her husband, approved approval from the borough to raise the existing, apparently they had an existing two-family residence, and construct a new two-family residence. So that was something that didn't come out in the appellate decision, but in fact, they had a two-family residence located in a single-family zone. But they were just simply asking to tear down what they had and construct a new two-family residence. But, as I said, because the plaintiff's property was in a single-family residence zone, the defendant borough did not have to agree, but they did allow construction, or actually in this case continuance of the property's two-family use, subject to the condition that one unit of the property would be limited to a personal owner-occupied residence. So that's very interesting. They could have, even though the plaintiff was seeking to just replace what was there, they could have denied it because the two-family residence was in a single-family residence zone. So then, as I said, they denied it. The court granted judgment to the plaintiff, concluding that the deed restriction and variance were arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable. And they noted that the two-family use of the property was legally permitted and was a legally permitted use of the property, and ruled that the defendant's conditioning was not part of its zoning powers. So interesting case because for attorneys this is interesting because having both the trial court opinion and the appellate court opinion really fleshes out this issue. And so I'm sure that a lot of land use attorneys are going to be looking at that one. There was that one, frankly, I don't think it was that interesting. There's a trust and estates case that might be of interest, even though it was not published, meaning it's not can't be used as precedent. But that was in the matter of the estate of Warren D. Collins. And the issue here was that there were 12 non-charitable beneficiaries of this estate of Warren Collins. And they received bequests in exchange for their execution of releases and refunding bonds. The state commenced the action and sought reimbursement from the 12 of their proportionate share of the inheritance taxes paid by the estate to the state of New Jersey. The decedent's last will and testament clearly burdened the bequest recipients with the obligation to pay the death taxes attributable to the benefits they received. So the probate judge determined that the state was entitled to the relief it sought, and three beneficiaries appealed. The beneficiaries raised numerous arguments. However, the appellate division found that there was a lack of sufficient merit to even warrant a written opinion, and so they affirmed. So this meant that they didn't even have enough for the appellate division to issue a written opinion, which is pretty rare, actually. There was another case where in Warren County, again, it was not published, but it was a Warren County case, and the county appealed from two decisions by the New Jersey Division of Workers' Compensation, and they were in favor of the petitioner, James Quillis. Now, first, the order that granted medical treatment and temporary disability benefits, and a separate order that awarded compensation benefits and attorney's fees. And the petitioner was employed by the county as a corrections officer. That's why, obviously, the county was involved in the case. So what happened in March 2014, he was climbing the stairs at the county corrections facility and injured his knee. He filed a claim petition with the division for his work-related knee injury, and the county admitted that petitioner was employed by the county, but the county denied that the injury rose out of and was in the course of employment. So the petitioner then filed a motion for medical treatment and temporary disability benefits. Again, the county claimed there was no accident and that the petitioner's injury was idiopathic. So what happened is the workers' comp judge found that the county failed to show that petitioner's injury was idiopathic and that the county failed to show an alternative cause for the injury, and that the injury was more probably than not caused by the incident. So in other words, they said that more probably than not he was injured on the stairs. So after the parties were unable to resolve the payment of temporary compensation and medical expenses, the case proceeded to trial, and the trial judge found that there was insufficient evidence of a prior or subsequent injury to petitioner's knee. So that, you know, that would be significant, obviously, if it was a prior injury. But the trial judge in this case said there was insufficient evidence of prior or subsequent injury. And the trial judge determined that the petitioner suffered a 30% permanent partial disability as a result of the injury. So now the Warren County appealed, and the county asserted that petitioner's injury was idiopathic and not work-related. The county also argued that the trial judge should have dismissed the claim for lack of sufficient credible evidence. That's important. Obviously, there has to be sufficient credible evidence, and the county said there wasn't enough. And they also contended that the trial judge failed to apply a functional limitation credit for petitioner's pre-existing knee injury. So the appellate division affirmed and rejected the county's argument that the injury was idiopathic and could have happened anywhere. The court also found that there was insufficient evidence to establish that petitioner had suffered a knee injury prior to the March 2014 incident. And finally, the appellate division rejected the county's contention that the compensation judge erred in failing to dismiss petitioner's claim based on lack of sufficient credible evidence. Now, one of the things in New Jersey, we have workers' comp judges. So they see these cases all the time. It's not like some judge who may have never dealt with this type of an injury or this type of a case hearing it for the first time. These are experienced judges, and I'm assuming that that made a difference to the appellate division. So let me play a few more commercials because I want to make sure to get them all in, and then we'll be back to talk about a few more cases.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
You know, I play this spot almost every week, and I never, or usually never, make any comments, but anybody who has any issues or family issues with mental health really needs to get in touch with NAMI. It's a phenomenal organization, and as we know, there are so many phenomenal volunteer and other organizations in Hunterdon, but reach out. I mean, they really have so many programs, so many ways of helping families help family members who need mental health. And I believe he said the number is 908-284-0500. And spread the word, because they will also help people who are dealing with, especially with children and young adults, with alcohol and drug problems. They can focus and tell you where you'll get the best help. This is an epidemic. I think everybody who has any awareness of the issue knows that families that are dealing with young people or anybody with mental health or addiction issues, you know, needs as much help as they can get. Anyway, NAMI Hunterdon is just a great resource.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody out there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Well, back for a few more minutes, and a couple things that people sometimes don't understand, and that is that, you know, there are times where federal law preempts any state law. There are other times where the state law really is the only law dealing with issues. But one of the things that have always been problematic, at least for family lawyers, is distribution of military pension plans. And in New Jersey, in general, the distribution of pension plans, it's like a distribution of any other asset when parties are divorced. In other words, a pension, a retirement, a 401k plan, they're all subject to equitable distribution. And in New Jersey, even plans that are not going to be in pay status for many, many years in the future, it's still an asset subject to equitable distribution, and the portion of the pension or 401k that's subject to equitable distribution is the portion that's acquired during the marriage. And based on the case law in New Jersey, that is from the date of the marriage until the date a complaint for divorce is filed for pensions and 401k plans, unless the parties agree on something else. But that is basically the time. However, if the pension is not going to be divided or in pay status until the future, even though the cutoff date is the date of the complaint, the non-employed spouse is entitled to the gains on that portion. Gains or losses. So the way that it is generally agreed to is, let's say it's a 50% divided by the years of the marriage and over, you know, the top number is years of marriage. Bottom number is years employed, And that, however, that's based on when it goes into pay status. However, there was a interesting case. It's been approved for publication January 5th. It's called Fattori, F-A-T-T-O-R-E versus Fattori. And the parties in this case were divorced following a 35-year marriage. And they were divorced in 1997. So, you know, here this case is coming up in 2019. And that's what makes it interesting, of course. At the time of the divorce, both parties were 55 years old. And the parties' divorce decree, there was a six-page consent dual final judgment of divorce. And the what happened is the parties included a mutual alimony waiver. And as far as equitable distribution, the judgment provided that the defendant wife would retain, no, excuse me, the defendant husband would retain the former marital residence that was in Hamilton, New Jersey, and also the mortgage obligation associated with it. And he would pay his former wife $55,000 as her share of the equity. And there was also agreement with respect to bank accounts, automobiles, credit card debt, etc. And it also, the judgment divided the parties' pensions. Now, the plaintiff wife had been employed as an operating room nurse in a hospital. And she had earned a modest pension as a result of that. And so they agreed that the parties agreed that the defendant husband had a 50% interest in what we call the marital coverture fraction. And that's what I had explained. So that would be, you know, he would get 50% of that. And however, they agreed that that had been offset against the equity in the marital home. So at the time, defendant was serving full time in the Army National Guard at the time of the divorce. And he had also accumulated a pension. And what the party's judgment, the agreement was, that they would, that the plaintiff wife would be entitled to receive 50% of the defendant's military pension, which was accumulated during the marriage. And they said this was via a qualified domestic relations order, QDRO. Well, that was their first mistake, because a qualified domestic relations order, what we call a DRO, that is then qualified, that language only works when it's a pension of a private company, because pensions for with private companies are ERISA pensions. They're governed by a law, ERISA, ERISA, federal law, and that's a quadro. Otherwise, a military pension is not a quadro. But it also said there were some other things about it. However, they did complete what they called a quadro of the defendant's military pension a few years later. And he continued to serve in the Army following the divorce until he became disabled a few years later. So at that time, he was able to collect his pension and disability his pension and disability without any impact upon the pension payout. He also received Social Security benefits. So at some point, he opted to receive disability benefits because they would be tax-free. So apparently the record in this case reflected that the former wife never contacted the former husband to inquire whether the pension was in pay status. And So for some reason, apparently, the former husband assumed she had received her share of the benefit. Although not unusual, although they have children and grandchildren, they had very little communication during the intervening years after the divorce. So finally, in 2010, the plaintiff contacted the Office of the Army, and they, with the office charged with administering the pension. So they were administering the pension. She was trying to find out what was happening and to find out why she had not received any payments. And then what she found out, of course, is that her former husband's disability pay, or that a portion of it, was based on disability. Therefore, it could not be divided under, this is the Uniform Services Former Spouses Protection Act. And that's what has to be used when we're talking about military pensions. So the disability amount is used as an authorized deduction. So in this case, when the disability payment was deducted from his gross pay, along with the survivor benefit portion, there was nothing left. So, nothing left. So what happened then, and the plaintiff's former wife filed a motion to compel the defendant to compensate her for her share of his military pension. And this goes back to 2016. The court conducted a plenary hearing over 2 days and considered the testimony. So after all of this time, this is what was happening. And what I'm finding is in a minute I'm going to have to wrap this up play the news. But in any event, the fact is, the bottom line is that a trial judge can only do things that will be acceptable to the military. And there has been another case, the United States Supreme Court decision in Howell versus Howell, a 2017 case. And as a result, a trial court, based on that case, the court may not indemnify a payee spouse when the payor spouse waives the military pension and receives veterans' retirement benefits. So, obviously, up until this case, people were not aware of it. Certainly, at this point and this stage, litigants can ask the court, the trial court, to award a disproportionate amount of other assets in light of the fact that a payor spouse can always waive a military pension and receive veterans' retirement benefits. So this is significant, and it's something that attorneys, whenever there is a possibility of a military pension, are going to have to be very, very careful about. So I think that is going to be about the end of the program, and I'll play the news, and we'll be back with the sports guys.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News with Wendy King.
Virginia's governor promises to remain in office despite widespread calls for his resignation. Ralph Northam is trying to distance himself from a racist photo in his 1984 medical school yearbook.
When I was confronted with the images yesterday, I was appalled that they appeared on my page, but I believe then and now that I am not either of the people in that photo.
Northam still faces a chorus of people calling for his resignation. He says he hadn't seen the